Nora and Delia Ephron have written a new play called Love, Loss, and What I Wore, based on the book of the same name by Eileen Beckerman, about clothes and the memories they trigger. It's being presented in a series of Monday night readings at the DR2 Theater on East 15th Street to benefit Dress for Success, a nonprofit organization that provides interview clothing and job support for low-income women getting back into the workforce. Karen Carpenter is the director of a rotating star-studded cast that includes Joy Behar, Tyne Daly, Blythe Danner, Debbie Mazur, Sarah Jones, Rosie O'Donnell, Parker Posey, Marlo Thomas, and Marion Seldes. I'm very pleased to welcome Nora Ephron back to this show today to tell us all about
it. So happy to be here.
You've written lots of successful screenplays, and there was Imaginary Friends, your witty and irreverent play about the celebrated feud that Mary McCarthy and Lillian Hellman had toward the end of their lives. But this is quite different from any of those things.
It's true. It is. But, you know, I read the book Love, Loss, and What I Wore a few years ago. And what I could not believe about it, because it's Eileen Beckerman's story of her life told through her clothes, Love, Loss, and What I Wore. And it's one of those books that you read, and it's not your life, and yet you start thinking about your own life. You start thinking about what you were wearing to the prom or what you were wearing when you lost your virginity, if you can remember it, and things like that, and what you wore at the great moments and the awful moments, and how much. And it's so powerfully interactive. And so I said to Delia, you know, maybe we could turn this into a kind of vagina monologues-esque kind of thing where you had a group of women talking about clothes and then interweave the story of Eileen Beckerman into it. So that's what we started out doing. And I think I had pretty much written this piece that's called I Hate My Purse.
Which is
part of it. And it's, you know, it's a group of sketches and monologues about clothes, about why we always wear black and the nightmare of buying a bra and all the things that make our lives, you know.
Not only the nightmare of buying a bra, but the nightmare of buying a bra when you are very young and you really have no need for a bra. The training bra.
Why do they call it a training bra? One of the women in the play says, are your boobs in training? Do they need to be controlled? You know, so.
And you realize that the vagina monologues approach, I guess it's also the approach that the Exonerated had of having a group of actors read different portions.
Yes, and true stories. Everything in it is true. We started out by writing everyone that we knew on email and just asking them to fill out a questionnaire about what their mothers had not let them own and all the things that mount up to those awful memories. And a lot of people wrote back these wonderful stories, many of them in the play.
So you've taken Eileen Beckerman's story, and that is often accompanied by drawings of dresses that are on display, and then included the other stories that you got from your friends for the rest of the play. I suspect that your journalistic background really helped here.
Yes, well, we did a lot of interviewing, both of us did. And then people want to write about this. And when people see the play, when women see the play, they want to tell you immediately about the time that their, blow-up bra deflated and whatever this reminds them of.
It's interesting that men were laughing just as hard as women when I saw the play, maybe because they've had some of these experiences, not the blow-up bra, but I know I laughed when somebody said, oh, gee, I should have hung that up last night, but also because they've witnessed a lot of this. If they've known a woman at one point or another, they've witnessed this.
That's true. Absolutely.
This is not the first time you've collaborated with Delia. Do you work well together?
Well, I think we do. I love to work with Delia because she's a hilarious person. So that's great. And, you know, if you are sisters, we're only 3 years apart, so we not only share half a brain, but we share all the same cultural references. We know who we're talking about when we're talking about whatever we're talking about, even though other people may not know. So I love doing it.
Both of you have written a lot about food, and you could do something like this about food as well.
The first time I ate sushi. Well, actually, my book Heartburn is a little bit like that. I mean, it's full of food interwoven with sort of the end of a marriage. But yes, I can remember. I'm afraid I can remember the food better than the clothes, probably. I'm obsessed with food. So.
Although an awful lot of women tell me that they remember clothes. Somebody just told me a story about introducing or telling somebody that she thought that she would work better with the other woman's boyfriend. And then years later, the other woman said, oh, you were wearing a jean dress that night and you had a yellow scarf on. She was stunned, but women tend to remember those things.
Some women do. Yes, some women have, you know, and then there are the rest of us who sort of kind of remember that the room was maybe square.
Perhaps.
Yes.
Can you imagine this being performed all over the country?
Well, that's our dream. Our dream is really that, you know, it's a play that's done with five women sitting on chairs. And our hope is that it will become something that women's groups and women all over the country can do and bring their own stuff to it.
Well, it was introduced as a work in progress. How much do you expect it to change over time?
Somewhat.
But from you?
I believe about it will change. It's still changing. In fact, it will change this week for the next week's performance. But it's mostly changing in terms of things that aren't working. We're going to pull them out and maybe try a couple of new things.
One of the things that comes across here is that women's identities are much more wrapped up in the clothes that they have worn than men's sense of identity.
What is men's sense of identity wrapped up in, do you think?
That's another show, and I'm not sure that we want to do it in public radio.
Yes.
During
love
lunchtime.
Loss and whom I slept with, right? I don't know. I think women think about clothes, absolutely. By the way, some men do too. It isn't just that women are the only sex that thinks about
but
clothes.
But there's more variety in women's clothes than men's clothes.
Well,
we could remember
thing,
that we were wearing a big lapel at the time or a different kind of tie.
Well, it's a thing someone says in the play, you know, that this thing that women do, choosing the sweater, unchoosing the sweater, choosing the sweater, unchoosing the sweater. Men do not do this. They just don't. At least to the best of my knowledge, they don't.
Well, they go through ties sometimes.
Sometimes, but just barely.
My guest is Nora Ephron, and she's written a play with her sister Delia Ephron called Love, Loss, and What I Wore. It's at the DR2 Theater. That's the Darryl Roth 2 Theater on East 15th Street. A charming little theater. And it's only being run on Monday nights?
Yes, for charity, yes.
And how did you get involved with Dress for Success?
Well, it seemed like a good idea. It seemed we wanted to do it for charity. We thought it should not be. It's not that there's a huge amount of profit in something like this, but it seemed to us that it would make it more fun for everyone. We're asking all the guests, you know, all the people who buy tickets to bring accessories and purses and anything they can for Dress for Success. But it just seemed like a way of doing it that wasn't conventional.
We had Dress for Success people on the show many, many years ago, and I remember thinking, what a brilliant idea, because one of the things we don't think about is how important clothing is when you go on a job interview.
That's exactly right, and particularly with so many women who have, you know, it's so agonizingly hard for women to throw anything out of their closets. The nightmare, this is something that's in the show, the nightmare of you know, when you say, if I haven't worn it in 2 years, no, if I haven't worn it in 4 years, I'll throw it away. And you just, maybe it will come back, whatever it is, as out of style as it is. And somehow knowing that you can give to Dress for Success, that there is a place where something that is nothing to you will have a life, is a fantastic thing. It's a great idea.
It also allows people to not be immediately marked as a member of a certain social class.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And which means that they are more likely to at least have an opportunity to get the job, not be dismissed immediately. Let's talk a bit about some of the women in the play. It begins and ends with Gingy's story. Is Gingy the character in Eileen Beckerman's book?
Yes, Gingy is Eileen Beckerman. Yes.
And Gingy was played by Marion Seldes the first night, by Marlo Thomas last night. Do you know who'll be taking the part in coming weeks?
Yes, Blythe Danner will be doing it, and Joyce Van Patten will be doing it, and I don't think I've left anyone out yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, but that's an impressive group. In fact, all the actors here are an impressive group. Are people begging you to be in this?
Oh, a few. We're starting to get those calls, but meanwhile, we were very lucky in that we didn't have a whole lot of trouble casting it. It's a Monday night. A lot of people aren't working anyway, but a lot of actors are off on Monday nights, so you can kind of get them. And it's fun to do. You know, you get there at 10 in the morning. We rehearse it. We do it at 8 o'clock at night. It's got that kind of Mickey and Judy let's put on a show quality. It's that reason why you go into show business, is the fun of this kind of let's just try it, you know?
I was amazed by how much of the script some of the actors had already memorized. Marlo Thomas seemed to know much of her part by heart.
Marlo had really worked. She was
just from rehearsing
fantastic.
That morning.
Yes, yes.
There are about 20
characters. Last night we had Rosie O'Donnell, and she was just brilliant. She's such a wonderful actor, and she doesn't really use that as much as she should, I think. So it was fantastic having her there.
Well, I assume you cast according to type, because Joy Behar and Rosie O'Donnell got the wisecracking, seen it all roles.
Yes, right. Casting, right. Yes.
Well, yeah. You've thought a lot about casting as a director.
Yes.
Some of the memories are obviously the kind of obvious ones that are related to clothes, prom dresses, wedding dresses in particular. Did you find when you were talking to these various women that they sometimes remember the clothes more fondly than the events themselves?
Well, especially if there were weddings, because as we know, at least half of them didn't work out.
And so were they fonder toward the wedding?
The best thing about my first marriage was what I wore to the wedding. It was my only good wedding dress, too.
Uh-huh. And later, what happened? Did you give up on the idea of getting a good wedding dress?
Well, I certainly wasn't going to get a wedding dress for the next couple of times. But I still wore really awful things my second and third marriages. I feel awful about it. I'd like to go back and redo those.
One of the stories.
It's that thing that I'm sure you do not know anything about, Leonard, but you do sometimes look at something and think, who did I think I was when I bought this? And
well, there's also, as far as the wedding dress is concerned, one of the characters tells the story of having a wedding dress handed down from grandmother to mother and
to daughters,
and any number of weddings by each of them. And finally, the last one says, why would I want to wear this bad luck dress?
Yes.
Because every marriage has ended in divorce.
And then hers ended in divorce, too. So there it is.
You also have a very contemporary story, the dilemma of what to do at a same-sex wedding. Is there more of a sense that the clothes need to make the right statement there than in a traditional
wedding?
No, that
was just a story that that someone told Delia about her wedding, and we thought it would be nice to make it into something that you don't quite know till it gets going, that it's not going to be a wedding with a bride and a groom. It will be a wedding with two brides.
And some of the clothes in these stories are odd. There's a paper dress story. I kind of remember paper dresses, although I don't remember anybody actually wearing one.
Oh, that paper dress came from a store called Paraphernalia, which was Betsy Johnson's first store at 67th and Madison. And that was one of the great stores ever. And almost, I don't mean everybody bought a paper dress, but everybody decided to buy one or not to buy one. They were so of the moment for one moment. And this paper dress meets with a small catastrophe, which I'm not going to discuss on your show. But in any case, it's very generational. I think nobody really remembers the paper dress who's much younger than I am.
It's also a story of a gang sweater. One woman, her cowboy boots, as in comparison to her husband's cowboy boots. And many of
her
these...
Her horrible boyfriend's cowboy
boots. Oh, was it
a boots.
Boyfriend?
Her
that's
horrible
right.
boyfriend, yes.
Many of these are mother-daughter stories. Is fashion one of the main ways that mothers and daughters relate to each other?
I think so, and I think that it's one of the... It's so amazing that there's almost no one you can ask about clothing as a child who won't tell you something their mother wouldn't get them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so huge in their brains, the thing that they could not have. One of my earliest memories was asking my mother for a muff. I mean, what? You know, my mother just laughed. She just thought it was a ludicrous idea, but I had seen one in a movie probably. You know, Margaret O'Brien had a muff or something, and I wanted one. And that moment where your parents don't even... They don't even take a moment to hear you. They just say no faster than you can imagine.
Well, they're often horrified by what the kid wants.
Yes, that's right.
A pink frilly dress of a sort that they wouldn't imagine their kid being caught dead in.
Well, either that or just, you know, there are a lot of parents who can't afford the things that their children are asking for, and this becomes a way that the child feels, you know, has some sense of the fact that there's no money.
You also include a funny montage of the things that mothers say to their daughters. You'd look so pretty if only you'd lose weight or gain weight or put on a little makeup or take off all that makeup.
Or eat fruit.
This is something that never changes.
Well, I think that's true. I think that a huge amount of it doesn't ever change. I'm sorry I didn't have daughters because I would have been very interested to see how, knowing what I know, would I have been any different from parents through the ages in terms of trying not to make all these mistakes. But you can't, you know, when you see these little New York girls running around, these kind of gossip girls with their Louis Vuitton bags at the age of 16. It's horrifying. It is so much more horrifying than anything I grew up with in Beverly Hills, where there were people with 21 cashmere twin sets, and I didn't even have one cashmere twin.
Now, why not? Your parents were successful screenwriters.
They didn't believe in that kind of spending money on clothing. They just didn't believe that you should be extravagant. They were expensive. I don't mean they didn't have money. They just didn't believe it. But that didn't mean I didn't want one.
So did you go to Hollywood High?
No, I went to Beverly High. I went to Beverly Hills High School.
And did you feel like the poor kid?
No.
Movie star kids all
were
dressed quite well, weren't they?
I think that I felt... Excuse me, I mean, it's ludicrous to say it. I think I felt deprived because I didn't have, you know, this huge amount of money being spent on my clothes. I was an intelligent human being even at that age, and I knew I was not in the poorhouse or something. But I think that's a thing. Clothing is a thing that is so much status in school, how many clothes you have, how often you have to change your clothes, and I think kids are very, very, very conscious of it. It's one of the reasons why uniforms really do make sense because it just keeps kids from being competitive in a way that is so superficial.
And it's another reason
for... But it's very emotional, you know.
But it's another reason for supporting Dress for Success.
Yes.
Because that kind of evens the playing
right.
field. The play is scheduled to run every Monday night for the next month or so. If the response is good, might it go longer?
That's what they're talking about, yeah.
And would you want to keep on doing it for Dress for Success?
I think we would probably try to do it in a way where we could actually pay the actors.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice, don't you think? I mean, there's a certain moment where you, if you want, what would be fun would be to do it with the same cast for a while and see what happened. But we're switching every single Monday, and that is exciting, too.
Because there's a certain revelation in hearing the way different, very expert actors approach the same lines.
I think one of the things that's so shocking when you do a play that it was so shocking to me was realizing that every single night is different. And when every single cast is different, it's so hilariously different every night. And, you know, if you're workshopping it, which we are, and something is good no matter who's doing it, you know it's good. And if something doesn't work no matter who's doing it, you know you better chuck it out.
Well, do different people get different laughs?
Yes, of course. Oh, my God, there are people who can squeeze blood from a stone. Oh, no, that's one of the thrills of seeing these wonderful comic actresses manage to get a laugh on something that you didn't even think was funny.
Well, maybe this will help you in casting your next film. You'll
yes.
know who can do what. Because when you're casting a film, you're trusting on past experience and what people have done for other directors.
Yes, that's true.
And here you've actually seen them at work.
That's true. But, you know, that it's also that thing called funny and that thing that Delia and I call NF, not funny.
Uh-huh.
And if you're funny, you're funny. And if you're not funny, you aren't funny. I
you
don't
mean,
know how to say this
you
more
mean,
clearly.
You mean so an actor who is not funny is not going to get, no matter how good the actor is in dramatic roles,
and
not going to get a laugh.
No matter how good the director is, being funny is its own gift. And the joy of this little thing that we're doing for charity is that you work every week with five really funny women. And that is just great.
And the budget has to be great because all you have to afford is five chairs.
That's right, five chairs.
And lunch. Nora Ephron and her sister Delia Ephron have written this play called Love, Loss, and What I Wore, currently at the DR2 Theater on East 15th Street every Monday night. Benefit for Dress for Success, a wonderful organization. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Leonard. Always.